Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, after years of a Saudi-led war, Yemen is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis on a scale hard to comprehend. At least 10,000 dead, looming famine, and now a shocking outbreak of cholera. But U.S. citizens looking to understand the U.S. role in driving the disaster or in potentially easing it get little help from accounts like that of the Washington Post, which told readers it's a complicated story. Shireen Aladimi, a doctoral candidate and instructor at Harvard University, will join us to talk about what accounts like that are leaving out. Also on the program, listeners know that hard-won net neutrality rules prohibit internet service providers from blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization of internet content, and how important that level playing field has been for everyone, but especially for those who've historically and presently had little voice in major media, including people of color, and for organizers. Former Verizon lawyer, now FCC chair, Ajit Pai, has had those rules in his sights since taking office, and now we're facing a December vote to repeal them. So what now? We'll hear what now from Aaron Shields, national field organizer for internet rights with the Center for Media Justice. All of that's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. In a world of shocking news, the idea of 21st century slave markets, human beings sold for a few hundred dollars, still stops you in your tracks. CNN published an explosive story in mid-November, terrifying video from Libya that shows young African refugees being auctioned, human beings described as big, strong boys for farm work and sold for as little as $400. As Ben Norton reported for Fair.org, CNN's multimedia story included videos, photos, and a chart, but no mention of NATO or the 2011 war that destroyed Libya's government. In March 2011, NATO launched a war in Libya expressly aimed at toppling the government of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. and its allies flew some 26,000 sorties over the country, launched hundreds of cruise missiles in what was initially presented as a humanitarian intervention, but later acknowledged as being about regime change. In this effort, reminds Norton, NATO supported an array of rebel groups, many of which were dominated by Islamist extremists and harbored violently racist views. Now, 6 years later, Libya is roiled by chaos and bloodshed. Many thousands have died, millions are displaced. But reports like CNN's and the flurry of stories that followed it ignore recent history and present slavery in Libya as an apolitical and timeless human rights issue. One exception was a New York Times editorial that linked the U.S.-backed military operation to the ongoing catastrophe. The April editorial called Libya's slave trading another level of horror and stated, quote, none of this would be possible if not for the political chaos in Libya since the civil war in 2011, when, with the involvement of a NATO coalition that included the United States, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was toppled. Migrants have become the gold that finances Libya's warring factions, close quote. That connection is commendable, though it's hard to forget that when NATO launched its war in Libya, the Times editorial board cheered it on. Norton cites Wall Street Journal reporter Sam Dogger and Andrew Gilligan from Britain's Telegraph, who early in the NATO war reported on the abuse of African migrant workers and black Libyans, assumed to be pro-Gaddafi mercenaries. They cited rebel slogans found in the city of Misrata, for example, referring to, quote, the brigade for purging slaves, black skin, close quote. The enslavement of African refugees and migrants is indeed a new level of horror. But media who don't acknowledge NATO's and the U.S. role in laying the groundwork are sidestepping a key part of the story. And finally, Counterspin noted the recent death of media critic Ed Herman. The New York Times noted it too. And like Counterspin, the paper's November 21st obituary included a comment from FAIR founder Jeff Cohen. But it also made a glaring and very Timesian error of just the sort that Ed pointed out. The Times' Sam Roberts wrote of the classic book that Herman co-wrote with Noam Chomsky, quote, "Manufacturing Consent was severely criticized as having soft-pedaled evidence of genocide in Cambodia, Rwanda, and during the Bosnian War, Srebrenica," close quote. Except Manufacturing Consent was published in 1988, years before the 1994 Rwandan genocide or the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. The book does deal at length with the Cambodian mass murders. It cites the work of historian Michael Vickery, who estimated that the Khmer Rouge executed some 200,000 to 300,000 people, with a total of about 750,000 excess deaths out of a population of 7 million due to killings, famine, and disease during their three-year reign. Vickery found that a lesser but comparable figure, about 500,000, were killed in the U.S. bombing of Cambodia beginning in 1969 and the concurrent Cambodian Civil War. The book did not argue that Khmer Rouge's Pol Pot was not guilty of mass murder, but rather that different standards of evidence and vastly different levels of outrage were applied to atrocities committed by the United States compared to those of official enemies, the latter having worthy victims and the former unworthy, in the book's terminology. Herman and Chomsky note that they came under sustained attack for insisting that the same standards be applied to mass violence, regardless of the perpetrators. As they wrote, quote, "Charges against dissident opinion require no evidence, and ideologically useful accusations will stand merely on the basis of endless repetition, no matter how ludicrous they may be," close quote. The New York Times' posthumous accusation that Manufacturing Consent was criticized for downplaying atrocities that happened years after it was published certainly falls in the ludicrous category. But after hearing from FAIR activists, the Times corrected the error. We thank everyone who contacted the paper. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The enormity of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen is staggering. At least 10,000 people have died in the last 2 years of Saudi war in the country, already among the poorest in the region. The UN says Yemen faces the worst famine the world has seen for decades, with at least 7 million people in need of immediate food aid. More than 500,000 children suffer from severe acute malnutrition, and millions more lack access to any health care at all. This while Yemen faces an outbreak of cholera that's being called possibly the worst in history. Yet Americans have heard little about what's happening in Yemen, and still less about how it relates to us. Shireen Al-Adeimi is a doctoral candidate and instructor at Harvard University, working to bring attention to the crisis. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Shireen Al-Adeimi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it has been noted that U.S. media are doing really very little, particularly television, on the ongoing disaster in Yemen. One outlet that did, CBS's 60 Minutes, reported compellingly and under difficult journalistic conditions about the famine and the bombing victims, and they indicated the Saudis as aggressors. But despite being a U.S. program aimed at a U.S. audience, 60 Minutes said not one word about U.S. involvement, leaving the impression of a regional conflict fitted into this familiar, reductive Sunni versus Shia framework. What would you have Americans understand about this country's role in the Yemen crisis?
Well, thanks for bringing up the CBS report, because that was a huge disappointment. It was this one opportunity for mainstream audience in the U.S. to learn for the first time, perhaps, what is going on in Yemen and what our role is specifically. But it was quickly, like you said, characterized as a Sunni-Shia conflict, which is far from the truth. And not once was it mentioned that the U.S. is, in fact, very much involved in Yemen and has been from the onset of the war. So when the Saudis decided to attack Yemen in March 2015, the Americans under Obama's administration were right there along with them in the command room, helping them with targeting practice, helping them with logistics and training. The U.S. military refuels Saudi jets midair as they're bombing. And so we have been heavily involved. We've continued to be involved under Trump's administration. And this is, of course, in addition to the billions in weapons sales that have occurred over the past couple of years.
There also is the role that the U.S. plays in sort of shielding Saudi Arabia at the U.N., isn't there?
Exactly. Over and over, the U.N. has failed to really take any decisive stance against Saudi Arabia. In fact, there have been some really outrageous moves. For example, they've been allowed to investigate their own crimes in Yemen. And, of course, they come out months later saying that they were cleared. So it's just been an absurd game that they're playing in the UN, and people's lives are at stake here, and we've been shielding them from any independent investigation.
Well, the latest headlines are about an easing of the Saudi blockade with some food and vaccines coming through, but we're told not really to take that as a sign of real easing of the hardship there.
Not at all. So it's trickling in. Whatever aid is coming right now is trickling in. And like you mentioned, 7 million people are in desperate need of that aid. You know, they need it immediately. But then you also have 20 million people who need food, who can't afford what little food remains in the country. And so we don't only need aid coming in, but we need trade. And in fact, we can't be begging the Saudi-led coalition to make these decisions and to hold an entire country hostage and to use starvation as a war tactic. In fact, we should be demanding that they end this intervention in Yemen so that people can go back to their lives and try to rebuild and deal with our internal conflict.
Well, the New York Times had a piece on November 22nd that talked about how this isn't any sort of natural disaster. You know, it used the phrases, when food is a weapon, when disease is no accident, and when civilians are targeted. And it even noted, quote, United Nations experts have warned that some of the actions carried out by the warring parties, the Saudi-led coalition and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels, could amount to crimes against humanity because of their systematic and widespread execution, close quote. Still, that seems to me to be at most talking about the U.S. pressing the Saudis and not about U.S. citizens pressing their own lawmakers here.
Exactly. This is presented as an equivalent war between, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran. And again, it couldn't be further from the truth. There's very little evidence that Iran is involved at all in Yemen. And the way Yemenis see it is that this is very much a U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen with the help of other regional powers. And so to characterize this as something just that's happening over there in a foreign land and we're trying to put an end to it, that's really not the case. We are at the center of this. And if our citizens don't really know our involvement, then there's no hope for us to be politically involved to try to push our elected officials to do something about our role in Yemen.
Well, we have, of course, Donald Trump bragging about $110 billion of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which the best thing you can say is that he's probably lying about that amount. But at the same time, the House of Representatives, they passed this resolution stating that U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen is not authorized under this, authorization for use of military force, this post-9/11 legislation. Now, it's non-binding. It doesn't actually stop the support, but it does acknowledge the U.S. role. How meaningful do you think that resolution is?
So the problem with that resolution is that it was a compromise resolution. The previous resolution was House Concurrent Resolution 81, which actually called for the U.S. to stop helping Saudi Arabia in any way, shape, or form. And that was proposed by Congressman Ro Khanna in California. Basically, he had invoked the War Powers Resolution, which meant that it had to go to vote and they had to debate it in the House. But it was quickly stripped of its privileged status, and they had to negotiate this compromise bill that was, like you said, non-binding. And yes, it acknowledged that this war is unauthorized, but it doesn't mean anything for U.S. involvement in Yemen. Nothing changes. We continue helping the Saudis without any repercussions.
And am I right that there is nothing in the Senate that's comparable?
There's nothing in the Senate right now. There are a couple of senators who have been vocal against this. So Senator Chris Murphy, for example, we need senators to introduce legislation that would extricate the U.S. from the war on Yemen.
Well, I read some of the comments after your appearance on The Real News, and one of them said, well, yes, you've outlined the suffering in Yemen, but what about the root causes? And what I hear in that is a suggestion that there could be some political or strategic consideration that would somehow make 7 million starving people make sense.
Of course, the U.S. has interests in the region. Yemen is at a strategic location at the Red Sea, and it's at the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. And there's some oil barrels that go through there every day. Not many in the grand scheme of things, but still the U.S. has interests there. And Saudi Arabia, of course, have always wanted to maintain control in Yemen, and they've been involved in Yemen's various wars and, you know, internal politics over the years. But this comes down to this alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States that we refuse to even reconsider given the tremendous humanitarian impact in Yemen. This is not just, as I think the Saudis had imagined, a war that was going to end in a couple of weeks where they were going to come bomb and leave and things were going to go back to normal for them. They didn't anticipate that this was going to drag on for 2 years and 8 months now. So we should be reconsidering our help with the Saudis. We're not just selling weapons, like you said. We're so involved in many ways, and every 10 minutes a child is dying. 130 children are dying every single day. 63,000 children died last year. 50,000 more died this year. So the numbers are incredible, and the suffering is just horrendous. At what point do we stop and say, well, maybe we should reconsider this alliance because it's not helping anyone?
Well, to the extent that that 60 Minutes segment referenced a U.S. role, it was by spotlighting the American who heads the U.N.'s World Food Program. So if anything, we're sort of the heroes of the piece. I have a concern that even as headlines come in about people dying, about cholera, that Americans will then talk about the need for the U.S. to take action, you know, as if we weren't taking action now, you know. So to be clear, if the U.S. were to cut off the refueling and the targeting aid and the shielding at the U.N., it would change the situation here.
Absolutely. Yemenis are not asking the U.S. to come and save them from Saudi Arabia. We have to be very clear about that. We're not asking for intervention. We're asking for them to stop this intervention, to remove themselves from this conflict, to stop interfering in the politics of Yemen and to cause this, you know, egregious humanitarian suffering by helping the Saudis at all these levels. And so if the U.S. were to stop, like you said, refueling, shielding the U.N., there are even reports that they're helping impose the blockade. If we stop all of this, then there's no way that the Saudis can continue this war much longer because they're so incredibly dependent on the U.S.'s support.
So if people are looking for something to do right now in response to this information, what would you recommend?
So I'd recommend that people call their senators and their congressmen, email them, visit their local offices, and really urge them to introduce or support legislation like House Concurrent Resolution 81 that really pushes the U.S. to stop its support of the Saudi Arabian in their war against Yemen.
We've been speaking with Shireen Al-Adeimi. Her October article, Only Americans Can Stop America's War on Yemen, can be found on Common Dreams. Shireen Al-Adeimi, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Boston Globe's technology writer says concerns about the FCC's plan to repeal net neutrality are overhyped. Probably what will happen if the agency eliminates the rules that keep the internet a level playing field, as it seems set to do, is not much. In the same column, Tiawatha Bray describes net neutrality as regulatory overkill on a massive scale. So, a massive-scale thing whose elimination will nevertheless not mean much. Should, for example, a company like Comcast block access to, say, Amazon Prime Video, so subscribers have to use Comcast service, Bray says millions of angry customers would just switch to a rival service. So, your head's already well scratched before Bray gets to the presumably ingenuous question, quote, What internet company would put itself in the crosshairs of public outrage just to gain a slight and temporary advantage over a rival? Close quote. Well, you may chuckle, but this is the level of arguments in support of the FCC's effort to repeal net neutrality rules. The truth is, advocates have everything on our side: public opinion, legal precedent, actual understanding of how the internet works. What opponents have, though, is corporate power and its government supporters. So what now? Joining us to discuss where we are in this critical fight is Aaron Shields, National Field Organizer for Internet Rights at the Center for Media Justice, one of the frontline groups on the issue. Welcome to Counterspin, Aaron Shields.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I suspect Counterspin listeners have a healthy mistrust of media corporations claiming that they would never go against the public interest for a silly little thing like profit, you know, but some might be persuaded that the effect of a repeal just might not be so bad or might not mean so much. You bring people to Capitol Hill to talk with lawmakers. What sorts of concerns do they have? What kinds of stories do they tell?
So a lot of my work is bringing people from the field who are doing work with media, organizing and movements, working in their communities to talk about what a net neutrality repeal would mean for them personally. And what you hear over and over again, this underlying issue around being able to control your own narrative. There are a lot of other things that a net neutrality repeal would impact, such as people's access to online education or to health information online. A lot of people in low-income communities and communities of color access education through the internet or doing their homework through the internet. But also, on a larger social scale, the internet has been critical to getting around larger media corporations' control of our narratives. And so a lot of times when we're talking with lawmakers and decision makers, what we're emphasizing is the internet's impact on our communities being able to tell our own stories. I'm thinking about Black Lives Matter and Standing Rock and a lot of the work that was being done by ADAPT up on Capitol Hill to stop the repeal of the ACA. A lot of that was powered by the internet and our ability to push back on these dominant narratives that are often pushed in mainstream media. And in these mainstream media arenas, oftentimes we're not even invited to the table. And so it's critical for us to be able to use blogs and Twitter and Facebook to share information, to talk about what's really happening on the ground. And I think that will be a massive blow to social movements moving forward if our voices aren't able to be blocked and censored in those ways.
Well, it seems as though, you know, the FCC has three Republicans and two Democrats, and they often vote along party lines. And so it seems as though this move to repeal may go through in this December vote. But that's not the end of it. What would happen? What happens then?
We're anticipating, as much as we hate to discuss it, that the repeal will happen. But what's next is likely many organizations like Center for Media Justice and EFF will take the FCC to court. And we feel like we have a great chance at winning because we've won in the past. I think you were touching on it earlier. The 2015 open internet rules have been upheld twice in court. And we believe that based on what we've seen, the orders that we've seen come out of the FCC around this repeal, that they don't have a very good standing if we were to challenge this in court. And on the other side of that, there's moves to pressure lawmakers to, you know, introduce some sort of net neutrality legislation. And while that may seem good on the surface level, what we're concerned about is, I mean, as everyone, I'm sure your listeners know, the state of this Congress is not hospitable to a net neutrality order that would keep the 2015 open internet rules as the floor. Of course, there are going to be, you know, ISP lobbyists in the room when that bill is being made. And so what we're asking congressional members to do now is to speak out publicly against this repeal and for the rules that we already have and to demand that Chairman Tai do his job and enforce the rules that have been upheld by court that were come to in a democratic way, millions of comments submitted supporting these rules, and to not be beholden to his prior employer and to these four ISP companies who would benefit most from this repeal. So there's still a battle to be had, and we don't want to lose organizing energy. We don't want people to, you know, take their ball and go home. After the repeal, there's a lot that we can be doing to pressure Congress into standing publicly for the 2015 rules. And if there is any legislation put forward, to make sure that it codifies the 2015 open internet rules and nothing less. We actually can't take anything less than that.
Well, so not that we are giving up on other channels, like contacting legislators, like contacting the FCC. All of that is necessary. But I know that we're also talking about going back to the street again, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We're planning on December 14th, the day of the vote, to have a massive rally in order to keep the energy up around this issue right outside of the FCC. We really don't want Chairman Tai to be able to repeal this without there being some sort of visible pushback and letting him know who exactly is going to be impacted by this repeal. I mean, I think a lot of times people think net neutrality is like this fight between internet companies. And it's really important for us, for CMJ in particular, to say, actually, hold on, you know, the repeal of these is not just going to cost more for Netflix, but it'll actually cost more for our communities, the ways that we're able to talk with each other, to organize, to access job opportunities, to access education. This has a real human impact, not just an impact on a corporation's bottom line. And so I think that's why you'll see in the coming weeks a number of demonstrations, actions, and really disruptions to business as usual, because we really can't let this repeal happen without letting our communities, the media, general public writ large know that we disagree, and that we disagree staunchly.
We've been speaking with Erin Shields. She's National Field Organizer for Internet Rights at the Center for Media Justice. They are online at mediajustice.org. Erin Shields, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.